Good evening and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Gina Cervetti. Tonight, a lecture entitled Some Reflections on That Uselessly Unpleasant Franco-American Relationship. The event, sponsored by the Institute for Human Sciences, features Michel Rocard, a current member of the European Parliament and a former Prime Minister of France. Rocard is introduced by Boston University philosophy professor Krzysztof Michalski.
My name is Krzysztof Michalski. I teach philosophy at Boston University in the fall, but today I'll be addressing you in my capacity as the chairman of the Institute for Human Sciences, both in Boston and in Vienna, your host today. Today's speaker is Michel Rocard, a politician, a rare case of an intellectual in politics, minister in various several French governments, prime minister for some time, a leader, a chairman of the French Socialist Party, but also an intellectual and author of various numerous books. Today he will speak about American-French relations, not easy relations. And now the floor is yours, Mr. Rocard.
Professor, ladies and gentlemen, this will not be exactly philosophy. I'm sorry for your discipline. It's an attempt to observe Franco-American relations. The exact title is Some Reflections on That Uselessly Unpleasant Franco-American Relationship. The history of Franco-American relations is absolutely incredible. Two friendly nations, sharing largely the same ideals, the same values, which in the strange world in which we live have never been at war against one another. It's a case. There is no others. And since in 230 years, that's unique. We were together in your independence war. Recently, a French writer, Monsieur Perrault, issued a book on the secret du roi. That meant the secret service of Louis XVI. And it began under Louis XV. And it's a long story of how difficult, precise, meticulous was the preparation of the French services and forces to prepare war to England in order to support the American insurgents, who were your grandparents, so far as I know. We then were next to one another in two world wars, and less visible, but still very important. France was, I think, the second European contingent, the second world contingent in the Korean War. And everyone has in mind that when became this very dangerous crisis of the fuses in Cuba, Charles de Gaulle had been the first chief of state immediately to, and after some marginal disputes, the first chief of state to send an absolutely definitive support to President Kennedy. Why is it that there is so much defiance and irritation bilaterally that has to be understood? Because in a word, it is stupid. And in the second, it is useless and damaging for managing present affairs. There are probably causes of national tempers or national ways of behavior. I do not like very much this type of habits. I believe in objective facts and more than in psychology. I do not believe at all something called people's psychology. I do believe that history teaches behaviors and consequences to every people, and that creates a correlation. But I don't much believe. Still, there are remaining, there are habits at least. On the French side, most likely we can isolate some jealousy in front of the huge, immense American success in building a nation, in building a power. Some regrets, too, still on the French side, of the almighty power of the 17th and 18th century. Some regrets of a lost colonial empire. Some regrets, maybe the biggest now, to see our language, which had been for centuries the world language of diplomacy, has been replaced, in fact, by English. You combine that with some natural arrogance. France is affected by what I would call provincialism with universal pretension. When the American people had to declare why it began a war against Britain to gain independence, they wrote a document, a constitution, and a charter. This charter begins by the Congress. It's for local use. And in fact, the main object was to prevent politicians and the state to invade private liberties. The French, not doubting of themselves, right, for humanity, generally, les hommes. Still, in spite of that, we are probably in Europe, the very country in Europe in which the percentage of people who speak one foreign language is the weakest. Furthermore, and more gravely, we are the European people among which the smallest percentage wishes and manages to live abroad. 4 times less than any Germans or Belgians or Dutch, and 10 times less than the Italians or even the British. We have some national pride. One is on wines. We sell to you Americans not half the quantity of wine that Italy sells. But there are some Italians here, many more, who call for them. That's a weakness in our trade balance. Corrected since. That is my delicious country. I'm very proud to be a Frenchman. I hope not to be too arrogant, but we have to be lucid. If I, and I try to, and this reason conduct the French people not to travel enough and not to know the world enough. This sometimes include even the top of our political hierarchy. As rarely as possible, we don't control, but still. On the American side, I'm obliged to quote the necessary ingratitude in life. Children cannot be eternally thankful to their parents. They have to live by themselves. That is true for individuals, it's true with nations too. There is in America too a fantastic pride. I wrote ivresse, but my drunkenness of your power. With no control, not yet confronted with the difficulties of the world, because you are, for that, a too young country. And this enormous, unequilibrated, uncounterweighted power, with a weak experience of history, is one of the problems of the contemporary period. All this is in some ways true, and it is it comes from history much more than it would be related with some mysterious genetic conformation of brains. I don't believe in that. But it could not suffice. And I think every element of our difficult cohabitation story begins in 1919. At that time, it was the French president after the end of World War I who was telling the discourse of nation precautions, of defiance on the national defense as an absolute priority. The generous discourse with a world vision and a wish to organize the world in a peaceful and manageable, organized way, was Wilson's. America spoke for the world at that time, and France for its security. You will find that the reverse, some other way around. A friend of mine, Jacques Julliard, used to say that we all have the same ideas. Our cultural patrimony is the same. Unfortunately, we never manage to have the same idea at the same time. We generally confront them erroneous times. Anyway, Wilson and Clemenceau. One word about Clemenceau. This man is highly respected in France, highly cultivated in history, I think excessively. The respect for him he doesn't deserve. The best of our prime minister during the First World War is not him, it's Aristide Briand, who was the longest and who was the man who organized resistance and consolidation of defense in Verdun, etc. Briand came in 1917 to the idea that military force would not create the balance, that millions of people already killed were sufficient, and that it was a world interest to make a compromise peace and not to try to destroy the other. Clemenceau tried to put him in Supreme Court for treason, and anyway succeeded in forbidding a compromise peace. And it is Clemenceau who wanted this disastrous Treaty of Versailles, which is not a treaty of peace, it's a treaty of punishment, which played a great role in preparing the conditions for the following Great War. So in my view, Wilson was right, and we were ready to become pro-Americans. Unfortunately, your Senate did not ratify the creation of the Société des Nations, Society of Nations, and therefore this Société des Nations came to birth very weak, incomplete, incapable to have any force, and this has played a role too in the birth of the Second World War. Anyway, it is probably the first great event for which you will find in the stratus of French historical minds, in all our co-citizens, a regret and a some sort of an anger against America. The Second World War shows our absolute solidarity. The first orange I have ever eaten in my life was given to me in August 1944 by a black American soldier. And the way you liberated us has created, at least for my generation and some of the immediately following, an immense feeling of gratitude. But the French political elite is not ready to remember that President Roosevelt, one of your greatest men, had nothing much to do with France, and that he had prepared AMGOT, Allied Military Government of Occupied Territories, and they had even printed the dollars of the occupation currency to circulate in France in June 44. We owe to the strength of de Gaulle by protest and the energetic refusal, and we owe to the political talent of Winston Churchill that France be recognized and be reconstructible. His relation with the United States, he felt a bit alone. We owe to him this decision. Unfortunately, I must remind you that this has had devastating effects in French public opinion, because all the anti-capitalists, all the extreme left-wing forces, complicated some entire Americanism with this argument, which was a bit too strong in my taste, in spite of the fact that you were our liberators. The bad story goes on with our colonial wars. In fact, in Franco-American relations, the capacity which misses most is to understand and more or less arrive to forgive to the other the mistakes. We can't forgive the non-ratification of the Versailles Treaty passed by the Senate. After the Second World War, France lived 5 or 6 years, oh no, more than that, a historical maladress, misfortune. There was a political desire in our elite to reconstruct the former colonial empire. And when, in the First Indochinese War, the defeat came, Prime Minister Georges Bidault, said President du Conseil des Ministres at that time, asked the American authorities to help us with a nuclear bomb. You were right to refuse. Congratulations, you did refuse. You had to do that. But you did not only make friends in France. Fortunately, you did that. Let's be clear. But there is a small cost. Then came the Algerian War, in which once again French governments misbehaved largely. Guy Mollet, at that time the leader of the French Socialist Party, could not really imagine that the whole people, 10 million Muslims, would come to insurrection against such clean, democratic, pacific, and well-oriented republic, whose device was freedom, equality, and fraternity. But colonial phenomena are more subtle. So he thought there must be an external factor behind that upsurge. And the factor was the fact that the leadership of that insurrection lived in Cairo. So we had the very brilliant idea, in alliance with Britain, sometimes better inspired, and with Israel, to invade Egypt, Suez, in order to first forbid the Egyptian nationalization of the Canal of Suez, and second, to give a strong lesson, and if possible more than that, to the revolutionary staff headquarters in Egypt. That I think I entered in a strong struggle against this decision as soon as we knew, and in fact, that the government had no popularity on that. It's a minority decision. Still, it was a great stupidity, and we owe to the United States once again to have stopped that by strong condemnation in the United Nations. Once again, you were right. But on the French prestige, even if mismanaged at that time, the shock was much bigger than the previous one. So when came the second Indo-Chinese war, yours, there was, in front of the difficulties, the reasons for which you lost the Vietnamese war are the same for us. Namely, to be as short as I can, we had general elections in the French Empire in 1936, in some African colonies, in the Caribbean islands, in the Réunion. We had independentists, which began, not in Vietnam. In Vietnam, the Communist Party made campaign on an agrarian reform and drowned in the peasantry with no excess, trying to improve the conditions of peasants in speaking terms with the authorities. And it is Japanese occupation, etc. But this is the origin of a fantastic strength in the peasantry of Vietnam, which explained the whole thing all along. And naturally, when the Vietnamese war began for America, the idea that some lessons could be taken from the French experiment were not accepted and even received. I traveled in the United States at that time. I was properly thrown away. We know best and we are stronger. You will see what you will see, etc. So the French attitude was intolerable for the Americans. It was condescendance. It was distant despise and some ironical smile. The cause deserved better. And all this among friendly nations who never missed the great occasions to be together. The crisis, the Cuban crisis of the fuses, falls. The Vietnamese war is not finished. And there we stand up. It's visible enough not to permit nuances. We are friends and we will remain. Then comes the longer and more complicated episode, which is the Cold War. The Second World War had a precipitated end thanks to the nuclear bomb on the decision of President Truman. Two bombs, Hiroshima and Nagasaki. This was very impressive. Very soon, Britain decided that it wanted to have its bomb. Easy to do. There was between a third and a half of British scientists in Manhattan Project in New York. So there was no great difficulty there. And the degree of mutual confidence, of absolute confidence between these two countries after what they had lived, was such that in 1946, with no difficulty, a treaty was signed between the United States and Britain, solemnly giving the military secrets necessary to build the nuclear bombs to Britain, which didn't need such a treaty. Britain had them already. Okay. What was less observed is the annex protocol. I have long thought it was secret. It was not secret at all. It was published. But nobody read. And that annex protocol said that in the case of... the treaty decided that nuclear forces of Britain would be under common command, which will be NATO command just after, but NATO was not yet created at the time of that treaty. And this command would be in the hands of the biggest power, the United States, naturally. Nothing to observe there. The annex says that in the case where the government of Her Gracious Majesty would consider that the vital interest of Britain be at stake, it would be sufficient for the Prime Minister of Britain to call on the phone, the American President, tell him, my vital interests are at stake, you are too long to react, I shoot. 12 seconds. That is in the treaty. And Britain managed the whole 40 years, say, of the Cold War to come with this diplomatic security installed in the strategic security given by the weapons themselves and the American strength. Naturally, France considered very quickly that it needed the nuclear bomb too, but the military performance of France during the Second World War was not very credible, and more importantly, naturally, we had at that time a huge Communist Party, which not only was the second most powerful in Western Europe, the first being the Italian, but was much more stupid and dogmatic. The Italians have evolved subtly in an Italian way to create a large social democracy. The French do not know what to do now that Stalinism is dead. Still, they were dangerous. And in 1945, these communists got up to 28% of the vote, which is considerable. So began there a terrible struggle between diplomacies and between secret services in order to try to impeach France to build its own bomb. We probably are disorderly people. We speak more than we do. We have all the defaults, national defaults that you do. We are good on public services. Make a nuclear bomb is a public service, and we succeeded. Naturally, in the absolute continuity of two republics, Médès France began the studies. Gibelet enlarged the field of the study, including military use of the nuclear reaction. And when de Gaulle arrived in power, thanks to the Algerian War, he just had to decide to go to military and to implement the thing with numerous examples of all that. We were at that time, we still are, member of NATO and member of the Political Treaty of Alliance and of the peacetime organization, military organization. Therefore, the French nuclear bombs became one more tool in the service of the common alliance. This is absolutely essential. At that time, no matter of prestige, no matter of defiance, the military doctrine was extremely robust and extremely convincing. This doctrine was called massive retaliations. At that time began another event in our scientific history, which is the birth of the computers. And the military began to treat signals, flying objects, automatically with computers. A film, which we call in French Docteur Folamour. I don't remember the... Strange Love. Docteur Strange Love. Yeah. L'amour étrange. Shows how began a nuclear war by accident. And this was very serious. Some 30 years after what I'm telling you now, I became a friend with Lee Butler, one of your former generals, commander-in-chief of all nuclear systems in the American Army. Lee Butler, a great general of yours, who just told me that one of the successes of our weak democracies was to have succeeded in hiding to public opinion a good 100 nuclear accidents, of limited size, naturally, but still. And this was becoming really very dangerous. So two courageous men, one is President Kennedy, the other one Bob McNamara, decided to change the military doctrine. This was urgent. Once again, probably you were right. but we have to understand what. And we came to flexible response. The message to the Soviet command changed. And it became, so long you don't shoot with nuclear weapons, we won't either. This did not at all change the confidence the Europeans had and still have that the solidarity of Americans is absolute, unfailable, and would act in any war situation, except that it would be after the time of a conventional invasion and the time for America to come back or to use nuclear weapons if the Russians would have done so. But in the contrary, we would have to lay a second D-Day with the price of some million deaths. De Gaulle understood. You have in America frequently the image of nervosity, anger, and an irrealistic gesture by colère, anger. It's not the case. De Gaulle spent 4 years maturing his decision, but finally decided to withdraw all troops, French troops, from the peacetime organization of NATO in order to reconstruct the French diplomatic autonomy to shoot the nuclear fire if we would perceive a vital threat on the life of the country. Earthquake, formidable debate in the whole Western countries, accusation of trahison, treachery in the islands, terrible affair. But he did so, and the French nuclear armaments were implemented, were used and placed efficiently in position. It happened, I have been a prime minister, and the fact to be a prime minister owes you a great ceremony, which is that you are initiated to what is all that and what could be used, and you are introduced into military secrets. So I had to see I was alone in a room protected from waves, you know that, and was presented all the maps of the targets. Some foreign people and some French people have laughed on the small size, so-called, of our nuclear power. It had 180 million citizens of USSR, Poland, East Germany, Czechoslovakia. 180 million. Not at all negligible. The world press mocked us, but the Soviet command knew. Some 15 years after all this happened, and a few weeks after I had resigned from my function as prime minister, I had a long talk with Henry Kissinger. It was a night. Dinner and wines were good. He probably spoke a bit more than you do in such circumstances. And told me this fantastic phrase. I must confess that he has denied since. But he was at that time competing for the Republican election, so I permit. But I swear what comes is true. He told me, finally, Michel, De Gaulle was right. It is true that no American president, in no conditions, in no situation, could have used nuclear weapons to defend anything else than its own territory and its own and his own population. 5 years later, I enter in the intimacy of a new friend for me. It's rare to make friends when you've passed, say, half a century. I made one with Bob McNamara. And I told him that story, asking him, you know that to see Kissinger and McNamara thinking the same way is rare. I told him the story and asked him his feeling. And the answer came immediately, no time to think over. Henry was completely right on the first point and completely wrong on the second point. And McNamara argumented this way. It is true that the Soviet command, and we have had proofs after, had understood flexible response doctrine as a doctrine which would forbid the use of nuclear weapons, would the Soviet not use them. which meant for the Soviets an immense boulevard of conventional activity, pressures, demonstrations, invasions of small-sized countries in the center. Everything was possible. The only unpredictable factor which could be considered a great danger by the Soviet command was the unpredictability of these foolish French. What would they do in front of a conventional threat? And contributed to the equilibrium of the whole system. Being authentified, I thought that before, but it's preferable for you to believe me only on the testimony of two former secretaries of defense. There we are. But what was the management of that genius? Francis France, as I told you, we were arrogant, pleased to play in the courtyard of the big boys rather than the small boys in the school, confined ourselves in an irritating head-to-head harassment between USA and France, and despised all those dwarfs which were not equipped with nuclear weapons. Our British friends, far from recognizing that we had just done what were the conditions to arrive to the same diplomatic autonomy and security than them, denounced us perpetually for 30 years as the bad pupil in the class of NATO, the irritable, the scandalous Frenchmen. And our diplomacy, instead of explaining, instead of traveling in all the capitals of the non-nuclear countries of Europe, remained arrogant, classified military secret in a doctrine discussion on all that. Our German friends are splendid. Our German friends have lived protected by all this nuclear system and deterrence. This is deterrence. For 30 years without having ever one parliamentary debate on nuclear deterrence in their parliament. And in fact, they permitted themselves to encourage anti-nuclear activists and militants to denounce the danger of the French. Okay. And therefore, no one in these countries, all others, not only Germany, knew anything about the logical and intellectual dimension of these deterrence calculations, and nothing either on the power of these tools and on their real danger. The result is, all around, an extreme amount of defiance. We still live on. But for the non-nuclears of Europe, the feeling was that those French, whom we other Europeans, don't understand why they behave this way, take the risk to diminish the degree of solidarity between the United States and Europe, which is the heart of our collective security. And doing this, neglect the security interests of who else in Europe is not French. Which is a false reasoning, but we were on our cloud and incapable to have a solidarity with the worry of the non-nuclears and to conduct a sufficiently insistent politic of explanation. So, 30 years is time to create a culture. And this culture is a culture of mutual defiance, with the main accusation of the French. Not because what they had really done, I think we were right, but because of the total incapacity to explain it correctly, whereas it was possible. That is arrogance. Now, having that in mind, you look at the rest. When began the European construction after the war, the French diplomacy still living on a standing superior to its real weight, expressed a bit too quick this foolishness to create a Europe which would compete with the United States in terms of foreign policy and defense and not only economy, etc. This not only was out of possibility, out of reach, but it was very irritating for the Americans themselves, but for our friends in Europe too. And it is probably because of this attitude that many governments, all with the British, but very frequently many others, have blocked political initiative in foreign policy in Europe under the condition of unanimity. And unanimity is naturally a paralyzing condition, but which permits to avoid the risk that the French would irritate the Americans too much. Then Europe lives its life without having any serious foreign policy. This life is extraordinary and very convincing. We have together in Europe and the United States rendered to the world a huge service without really desiring or projecting it at the beginning, which is to have highly diminished customs tariff and non-tariff barriers. When the first common market was created, Traité de Rome, 1959, the United States said, okay, marvelous, we need you to unite. We are fed up to find solutions for your wars. But your external common tariff should be much lower than what is written in the treaty. The treaty said it would be the average between the national tariff barriers of the six founding countries. And thus was opened the Kennedy round. And then, I'll make the history short, at every new enlargement or every new intensification of the construction of Europe corresponded a new customs negotiation, which was, after the Kennedy round, the Tokyo round and the Uruguay round. All this was under pressure. The American vision was that a united Europe would be more peaceful and create less mess on the planet, but under the condition that it would be an open market. And since we were reconstructing our industries, mostly defeated, demolished by the war, open market had a heavy significance. Our Latin American friends know what is the opening of customs borders in unequally developed economies. But we leave that. We succeeded. The reconstruction was accelerated thanks to the common market. And the common market was, in fact, a growth incentive, a fantastic growth incentive. And that was a real success. But during the 20 years in which this success is confirmed, many neighbors want to come in, and they do. Most of them for political reasons linked to their security. Look at Greece. What interest could have the small Greek economy to enter in full competition with those small elephants, the big elephant is you, small elephants that are Germany and France? It was economically stupid, if not suicidarian. But they were finishing the phase of dictatorship of their colonels. They wanted a democratic label. They wanted to be intricated in a democratic system which would make impossible any new coup d'etat or any new coup of their military. And that's why they came. And just after came the Spaniards and the Portuguese for the same reasons. For the same reasons. During the negotiation, a lieutenant colonel called Tejero tried a nouveau coup d'etat in Spain. The fact that the king could convince him that Spain entering Europe forbade absolutely such behaviors was part of the success in getting rid of that. So the economic history of Europe is a fantastic success, as you know, with two enormous results now. One is the creation of the euro, and the other one is a very powerful position of Europe in terms of trade and preservation of competition. America has largely renounced to its old and serious and respected tradition of antitrust. 1890 was the first antitrust law. Since a good 15 years, America has a bit forgotten all that and defends natural champions because the world has become more dangerous. But when Boeing and Douglas wanted to merge, Europe has said, do it, you are Americans, you don't depend on law for us. Unfortunately, we have rules, serious rules. If you are a world monopoly, you won't sell planes on our market. They did not merge. The same story came after for Microsoft and Honeywell with the same conclusions. And we are now debating on patentability of software, and it is in the European Parliament. The American justice have not yet spoken. That is defended, the freedom to communicate the results of human knowledge. And that is enormous because we are 500 million consumers among the richest in the planet. So the achievement on this side is enormous, but during that time, nothing happened on the side of defense and foreign policy. Then came the shame, and the shame is the former Yugoslavia. Having no habit, no competence, no legal title to decide anything about former Yugoslavia, Europe takes 3 years in thinking on what to do, and when after 3 years, 200,000 massacred people decided to do something, what they did is to call for the help of the Americans. This is the good quality of our relations, as you know. So this shame conducted to people to accept to do something. The solution was found in Petersburg, 1992. Petersburg is to Bonn, German capital, what Versailles is to Paris. A splendid suburb for happy ministers in good hotels. In a negotiation in which they decided not to take in charge our own security, which is NATO commanded, and this will not be touched, still confirmed. But there are tasks of a military nature which cannot be conducted by NATO, which are first, the rescuing of any European resident or citizen being in danger anywhere in the world. Second, to protect militarily humanitarian operations, be them medical or treating hunger. The third, to participate in United Nations peace missions when they consist in maintaining peace or putting intermediary cordons of soldiers between people who hate one another. And the fourth, participating to United Nations mission of security, even in peace, must be enforced, shooting. Those are the Petersburg mission, for the service of which we are developing a small unit of 60,000 personnel, capable to be projected anywhere in the world. It will not begin in Latin America. So this is Mediterranean mainly. And capable to stay there 1 year, which means that concerned are 150,000 people at least. That's all, and that preserves our mutual consensus in spite of some French desire to do more. The mutual consensus is to respect the strategic equilibrium in which our security is organized by NATO collectively. That's where we are. Then came Iraq. And on Iraq, we shall pay the result of all this defiance, mismanaging of relations, which have no reason to be so bad. There was not enough mutual confidence just to speak about the problem, clearly. There was, on Iraq, an inversion of position. Wilson would spoke universal and Clemenceau, national pride and national defense. It is now France who has a universal speech about peace, avoiding strikes and trying to get out of problems through negotiations. And the American presidency, which speaks the hard language of national security. But the fact is that all lessons of history were not listened to. The greatest surprise for Europeans, and especially for Europeans who are friends with the Americans, which is my case, is this decision, which has no authorized military command in the United States, so far as I know, to renounce temporarily, to go on with the struggle against Bin Laden and get busy with another criminal, Saddam Hussein, but his criminality was not of the same kind and was not a threat for us, which gave 2 years of space to Bin Laden. We consider friendly that our American friends have done here a great mistake. And the second mistake is the absence of any sociological method of work. sociological thinking about Iraq. Democracy is a cultural product. You cannot parachute democracy with tanks. And if you want democracy to be created somewhere, you need decades. And with local origin. All this we should have talked about. And in fact, you understand that I'm pushing an appeal in a way. We must put an end to all these misunderstandings because they are costly. I think the two mistakes I describe here could have been interpreted as technical mistakes. There would be no shame to exchange information. The result of that is the choice by the American authority of a strategy which, instead of isolating terrorists of the population in which they live, to conduct those populations to reject terrorism under the condition that some future be open to them, including in food and in growth. We have had a global strategy which unites the terrorists and their population. This strategy, we should compete in anti-terrorism. And after all, we never had the equivalent of your two towers in terms of numbers of killed at one time. But Islamic terrorism hit France 12 years before you. And our police services and our public opinion are quite aware we live under terrorist ambience, too. Don't believe you are alone. You have been symbolically much heavily struck. This is a global problem which should call for a global strategy and which we should discuss together. If not, Professor Huntington, who teaches not far from here, would be right. We are going towards the shock of civilization. We should avoid it. We are not presently really. My great fear is that this fossé, the gap between the United States and France could be deepened if we are not careful enough to take it in charge and to try to fulfill it. That is one of the challenges which are at stake in your next election. If both boats go away on different paths, I don't know how we shall meet again. I am sure it is avoidable. One more comment. It's not an affair of Mr. George W. Bush alone. It's an affair of the culture of a very strong people who's discovered force without having the culture of the limits of this force, and which is not, it's an intra-American problem, not capable to equilibrate the need for hard power. The world is not peaceful. We need hard power. We need that you have hard power. But not alone. And the share of space which is occupied by soft power, because finally it's soft power which creates human cohesion, which consolidates peace. This equilibrium is an intra-American choice. You are alone to do it, but it will completely modify, according to one or the other solution, our future. I am relatively optimistic. You're great. You learn quickly. Probably you learn more quickly than my own country. Thinking of Vietnam, which has been occulted, wiped out at the beginning of the Iraqi war, will come again there. And what happens in Iraq, which is terrible, is rich of other feelings. Incidentally, we have now, the Westerns, we'll probably join you now that sharing the burden is on the agenda. We probably will sharing you. But we have no right to get out of there before they're capable to live together. How long? Goodness knows. I would be afraid of any precipitated engagement to withdraw. With those learnings, my belief in democracy, my confidence in my American friends, my confidence in the capacity of my own country to dominate some arrogance and some bad historical traditions, but to be serious at all on the final point, is such that we should reconciliate. It will not be easy. The meaning of what I have tried to say today, that we shall not reconciliate two histories, two countries at that time without working, controlling history, learning it, and having judgment on our own faults. There are faults on both sides. We should recognize them and contribute to a mutual forgiveness or forgetfulness in clarity. Silence is not good for that, but the future is for democracies when they are united. Thank you.
You've been listening to a lecture entitled Some Reflections on That Uselessly Unpleasant Franco-American Relationship. The event, sponsored by the Institute for Human Sciences, featured Michel Rocard, a member of the European Parliament and a former Prime Minister of France. Rocard was introduced by Boston University philosophy professor Christoph Michalski. For a CD or cassette of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. CDs and cassettes are $15, which includes shipping and handling. Tonight's program was produced by Tim Skog and Matt Odette, with help from Mike Toda. Our web producer is Angel Cazelli. I'm Gina Cervetti. Thanks for joining us.